Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber, and I am very lucky to have the wonderful Rob McNelly with us today on the show. Rob's a A-list first call session guitar player and songwriter living in Nashville. And here's just some of the artists and the albums that Rob has played on. Check out these names. And this is literally scratching the surface. Buddy Guy, Lady Antebellum, Sean Chambers, Frankie Ballard, Delbert McClinton, Joe Nichols, The Judds, Tinsley Ellis, Dolly Parton, Randy Houser, Joe DiMessina, Montgomery Gentry, we're only halfway, Toby Keith, Dolly Parton, Kelly Pickler, Hank Williams, Dierks Bentley, Dustin Lynch, Thomas Rhett, Josh Thompson, Kenny Chesney, Bob Seger, Rascal Flatts, Joe Louis Walker, Eric Paslay, Carrie Underwood, Amy Grant, Low Cash, Toby Keith, Leroy Parnell, Lee Bryce, and literally dozens and dozens of others. I'm exhausted just reading that, man. His style is influenced by a lifelong love of electric blues, R&B, and roadhouse rock and roll, which you can hear in his playing, especially in his own EP called RMC Volume 1, which you can find on Spotify, and I would highly encourage you to listen to it, and I'm not blowing smoke. It's a really wonderful album, and we'll talk to Rob about that today. The emphasis here is on Rob's on his EP. It's the emphasis is on Rob's vocals, lyrics, and writing, with his fretwork tying the package together. It's extremely well written and very well thought out and deliberate. And Rob has a comment that he said somewhere I read online. He said, I try to, with my fills and my guitar looks, I try to find the cracks in the music and then I throw a hook into those empty spaces. And I listen to the album literally six or seven times. And that is a really good way of putting it because everything is so tasty there and those fills are just like, you know, spilling the right amount of water in between the rocks, man. So nothing's flowing over and it's just like perfect.
Oh, cool.
As a session musician, Rob's landed a string of high profile gigs and awards, including Guitarist of the Year from the Academy of Country Music in 2014 by focusing on the rhythmic riffs that dart in and out of each song, never crowding the melody. He also played the main guitar part on Thomas Rhett's Die a Happy Man. He played guitars on John Party's California Sunrise record, as well as Kid Rock's newest stuff that he's putting out. He's currently on tour with Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band as a lead guitar player, and he's featured in the documentary Hired Guns, which is a documentary about Sidemen. Rob, thanks so much for your time, and I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Craig. I'm glad to be here.
Hey, so I want to talk about your EP, but real quick before we start, you've worked with so many iconic, really legendary people, and I was just curious, what did you learn? I want to know, I'm just picked randomly three artists, well, not randomly, three people I'm interested in, that what was your biggest takeaway, the lesson you got from working with Bob Seger, and how did that gig come about?
Okay, well, you know, the biggest thing that I take away from Bob is just the strength of a song. You know, he's got so many songs that we all know. And when you really start thinking about it, whether you're a fan or not, it's iconic music. And there's a reason that we've all heard those songs. We did a couple shows with Kid Rock where Kid Rock opened. And you know, if you've ever been to a Kid Rock show or you've ever seen anything of him live, you know he puts on an amazing show. I mean, there's all this stuff going on, great lights, great, you know, characters on stage doing all kinds of crazy things. It's like going to the circus. And then with Seger, we all stood side stage the first night of those shows and thought, how are we going to follow this? Because we don't have any of that. I mean, we don't. It is just dudes standing on a stage playing music. We don't dance. We don't know any of that kind of stuff. And, man, we got up there and we realized, and even Kid Rock said this after our show. He was like, man, if you got the songs, you just don't need any of that stuff. You just stand up there and play your songs and people go nuts. Mm-hmm. And that's the strength of Bob Seger. I mean, he obviously has a great voice, and he has charisma, and he's a character. I mean, he's bigger than life when he comes out on stage, you know. But man, the songs—it just drove that point across. And you know, So that's what I admire most about him. And you know, I got the gig through, I think you're going to be interviewing Moose pretty soon.
Okay, yeah.
He's already in the band. And he's a Nashville guy, and I've done a bunch of sessions with Moose and have gotten to know him over the years. And he recommended me when Kenny Greenberg, I don't know if know that name.
Yeah, I sure do.
He did a tour with Bob, and then he wasn't going to be able to do the next tour. He had taken some other gig with Kenny Chesney and was going to be gone with him. So Moose recommended me, and I think Kenny recommended me as well. So they heard my name in two places that they respected, and then Bob flew down to Nashville a couple of days, and we just played through his whole entire show. I mean, he just kind of taught me everything I needed to know Bob Seger related, and we just kind of hit it off and got along, you know. So that's how I ended up getting the opportunity to play with him.
Were those the biggest crowds that you'd ever played in front of?
The most enthusiastic, maybe. Yeah. Well, I don't even know if I would say that. They sound like the biggest crowds I've ever played for. Right. I mean, you know, I've done arena tours before. I mean, you know, way back in the day, I played on the Judd Reunion Tour back in 1999. And you know, those fans were just as rabid to hear them after 10 years of absence, you know, or however long they had been out of circulation, as Bob Seger's fans are to hear him every night, you know. So I mean, I was kind of used to it, but I got to say, I've never played for crowds as excited as that, and shows that felt that exciting as far as the energy in the room every night. I mean, it's Bob Seger's pretty much the biggest thing I've ever been a part of live. So
that's great. How about Buddy Guy?
Yeah.
What did you learn from Buddy, and how did that gig come about?
I'm friends. I've worked a lot with the guy that produces him, Tom Hambridge. He produces a lot of records, and we've been friends a long time, and he's hired me to play on a ton of different things. And when he started producing Buddy Guy, he called me. I guess it's because we just have a good rapport musically. So Buddy Guy, the biggest thing I learned, he's everything that you think he would be. He's just a straight up nice guy that's been in this business for a really long time. You know, the best thing that I like about being around Buddy Guy, besides looking over and seeing him play his ass off, is you know, the downtime when you're hanging out in the lounge in the studio and he starts telling old Muddy Waters stories or Little Walter stories from the heyday back at Chess Records, you know, and realizing that not much has changed for Buddy Guy. He's remained this consummate guy that just followed his voice and his craft, you know, and that's all those guys ever did. They couldn't be anybody else, you know. You can't picture Buddy Guy doing anything else other than what Buddy Guy is doing. It was not a choice for him. That's just who he is. So that's a huge thing, you know.
Did you tour with him or only studio work with him?
I've only played on I think the last three records, or I've only played on his new records, yeah.
When you first, like, see him pick up his Strat and you hear him playing, what is it, like, what was going through your head? Not as a fanboy, but as somebody who, you know, I know the kind of music you play personally, so I'm assuming he had to be one of the 10 guys that you listen to on the regular rotation, sort of, yeah. What was that like when you're sitting there and you're, like, looking at Buddy Guy playing his freaking Strat?
Well, honestly, it is a total fanboy moment. And it was like this with Seger, too. You know, I mean, hearing either one of those guys. I mean, the thing about Buddy Guy that to me was really cool, and he probably wouldn't remember this, I don't think. But you know, the first time we started playing on something together, we were in the studio. We just listened to a demo of a song that I demoed up with his producer, where I played the guitar and I was trying to play like Buddy Guy. on this demo so that he'd kind of hear himself in this song and want to do it. And well, he dug the guitar playing on it. So I kind of, you know, he had a real way of making me feel comfortable about being there because, you know, he's a guitar player. I'm a guitar player. He doesn't need me.
Sure.
You know? So we got in there and we just kind of started playing, and I started playing like the rhythm to the song, you know, and he just kind of looked over and started smiling, and right away we got into a musical conversation.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
So then, you know, you hear the power in his tone, you know, when he clicks on that thing and starts playing like Buddy Guy, it's so powerful. And it's the same way when I was sitting there for the first time, like sitting 2 feet away from Bob Seger, and he starts singing Night Moves. You know, instantly, yeah. I'm a 14-year-old kid in my bedroom listening to my boombox, and there's that voice.
Yeah, you know? That's pretty cool, man.
It is really cool. It's the things about doing, if you do this long enough and stay with it and keep going in this business, you know, you just kind of end up hopefully in these places.
Yeah.
You know, and they're indescribable moments, you know.
I don't know if this is a fair question or not. I've seen Buddy in concert. Like, I saw him once in the 80s, and I've seen him probably 5 or 6 times. The last couple of times I've seen him was, I live in Tampa, so he came down to Ruth Eckerd Hall in Clearwater.
Yeah.
I could swear to God he was hammered walking around. He's got the wireless mic, and he's walking around. Motherfuckers, what are you looking like? He had to be hammered because he was just saying this off the wall shit. Not because he cursed, but just how, you know, his, you know, when someone's drunk, you could tell, right? Is that like, I don't know if you could even answer that question, or is that, what's that all about? if you could answer. If not, I totally get it.
You know what, man? Well, it's not that I feel uncomfortable talking about that. I didn't see that side of him.
Okay.
Well, the motherfucker part, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Everything's motherfucker. You know, he that's how he talks.
Right.
But I never saw him drinking or anything in the studio.
Okay.
You know, he, you know, I guess because we work during the day and, you know, we don't go late into the night, you know, usually on his records. He's pretty sober and he's quiet, you know, until something reminds him of a story, and then he lights up and starts telling you all this stuff, and it's motherfucker this and motherfucker that.
Yeah,
it was everybody in the room's name is motherfucker. You know?
Yeah,
it's good. Yeah.
Did that's really cool. I had a question in my head; it just slipped out. Oh, did you have to go up to Chicago, or did he come down to Nashville?
He came down to Nashville.
Okay. Yeah. Dolly. How'd you get that gig, and what did you get the most out of Dolly?
Dolly is just another person you grow up with, especially if you're our age.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I remember looking at Dolly and thinking she was beautiful, you know, growing up, you know, seeing her on TV or whatever. And her, you know, she comes in the room and acts just exactly like you'd want Dolly to act. She's in a great mood. She's upbeat. She's happy. She, you know, I think the thing is, man, she just came right up to me and gave me a big old hug and said hi, and, you know, and the thing that I wasn't expecting, because we work with so many artists that sometimes don't even show up at their own sessions.
Oh, wow.
And then if they do, they kind of save their voice. They don't sing all day. You know, but Dolly sang every take of every song we did all day long, like it was the performance.
Wow.
And that was the first time I'd ever been in the studio with somebody who really did that. Now, there are others that I've been in the studio with since that have done that, but she was the first. And it reminded me that, hey man, you got it. There are still people in this business that can sing every time they need to, and they treat it like it's the most important thing they do, you know. And she was definitely one of them. That was really cool.
Do you know Dave Fowler, bass player?
Yeah.
Dave was touring manager for Dolly, and I asked him that question, and I said, "What did you get the most out of Dolly?" He said, be on time.
Yeah.
He said she is such a stickler for time. If you're not 20 minutes early, you're late, you know? And yeah. He said he was, and maybe because obviously him being touring manager, he carried a little more of that responsibility, but he said be on, you know, that's like, if you're not on time, you're gone, you know?
Yeah.
Pretty quickly. So
I could see that. Yeah. I mean, all of us session musicians, everything's so regulated. We're always on time.
Yeah. You have to be here. Hey, man, let's talk about your EP, RMC Volume 1. And hang on, okay. I just thought of something. Okay, sorry about that. One thing I noticed is that the actual layout of the songs, you know, the sequence of them, 1 through 6, it's really well done. I thought that each song was very well placed exactly where it should be placed, especially having that, Eloise... The final song. That was like, that's when you used to have an album, that's the long playing, you know, the power ballad. It had a haunting piano line. And I was curious, like, is that a hard process to do, or was it just random luck? Or, I mean, I wouldn't imagine it, but how did you decide where to place?
No, you know what? Yeah, I think that is definitely something that I always... Every time I've ever recorded a record, I've always put a lot of thought into the sequence, and I usually don't do it by myself. And I should say there's a buddy of mine that I've been friends with since childhood, who's also in the music business. He's more on the business side of things, and his name's Cliff Audridge, and he's my oldest friend, you know, and we know each other very well, and I co-write a lot with him. Some of those songs are written with him. And so he's always around and involved in everything that I do, either in a production role or he's my ear, you know. Okay. I really trust him a lot. So he and I sat down and really batted around the sequence of that CD a lot. And that's probably his sequence. I remember him calling me. We kicked a lot of things around, and then I remember him calling me one day and saying, "Man, I don't remember if he dreamed it or something, but he said, man, I just as fast as I could write it down, the sequence came to me, and that's it. Check this out." And when I did, it was just right, you know.
Yeah, it seemed very deliberate. I would have been shocked. I mean, once in a while you hear, "Hey, man, I winged it or I lucked out," but it just seemed so deliberate because it was really, you know, like a puzzle. Like all the pieces fit and made the puzzle perfect. You know, so I was.
Well, thank you. We did put time into that, so thank you. Yeah.
Did you? You said you. I had a question. Did you write all the songs? But you said you and Cliff co-wrote most of the songs.
It's either. Well, let me think. I wrote some of those by myself, like Just Walked By Until Then, I wrote by myself. Eloise is with Cliff. The Secret is with Cliff. Nothing But You is, I wrote that with a couple of Nashville writers that I do sessions for, Matt Nolan and Matt Warren. And People Just Love to Talk is a song that I wrote with Delbert McClinton and Kevin McKendry. And actually, we recorded it. We wrote it for... one of Delbert's records. He recorded that on Acquired Taste, which is not the last record, but maybe the record before that, I think.
That's a cool song. It's like a cool tune.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah,
thanks.
Just a cool tune. I love that.
Yeah, Delbert is such a great lyricist. I came in, I had most of the music bed, and I had the chorus. I had the lyrics to the chorus, and I just threw it at him, and we just sat there, and he just started saying all this really off the wall stuff that fit that chorus. I mean, it was amazing, man. I loved riding with him that day because it just was, he blew my mind.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, sometimes you're in the right place at the right time to make that magic too. And yeah, you definitely were there. So how deep did the writing get, not lyrically, but musically, for example, in Eloise, did you write the moving piano line itself, or did you just, you know, write the chords and you bought people in to do this other stuff? How much freedom and creativity did you give, and what did you play besides guitar? Was that it, and vocals?
On this record, all I played was guitar.
Okay.
All the guitars you hear on there, acoustic or electric, but, Eloise, you know, that was actually a guitar figure. before it was piano figure.
So you wrote that line, that melody in the on guitar, and then put it.
Right. Actually, that's not true, because you know, in the outro where we sing the melody,
mm-hmm.
That's where the melody kind of came first in the play. We didn't have that up front. When Cliff and I were writing that song, we wrote the song, and then we were like, man, we need a long like outro thing that just repeats over and over again, and I just started singing that.
And
so that's kind of how I came up with it. And then for years, you know, I would play that song around for people, just me and an acoustic guitar. And so I played the melody on the acoustic guitar, you know, where you hear the piano doing it on here. But when we got in the studio, we kind of wanted it to sound like, so a lot of people say it makes them think of Hey Jude, and I understand why they say that because of the outro, but really we kind of thought of it as, you know, 70s Elton John meets.
Yeah, like, right.
Right, like if Elton John had played either on the Rolling cut off of Rolling Stones "Exile on Main Street," like one of those ballads, or Keith Richards played on an Elton John record.
Sure,
we kind of, that's where I was coming from as far as my headspace on it. You know.
Yeah, it's that line is it really? I don't know. I just felt it. It's funny. Certain. It's sort of like directed. You know, the guidepost of the song was that line, that piano line. I thought it was, you know, like it's like a guide, you know, a guidepost is the best way to say it. It was good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. I like that about it too. It's like, it's the theme that keeps coming back at different points in the song. You know, it's like the home base of that.
Yes. Song. That's a good way to, the home base for sure.
Yeah.
And I had a question here for Rob about his voice, but we talked about it before, but I just want to tell everybody if Rob would have said to me, hey, I'm a lead singer, I would not have, if I didn't know he played guitar. I mean, the vocals in that are great. So check out the vocals. I want to ask you some specifics about the tracks. Just Walk By. Is that a telly at the end in that solo?
No, actually I played an old Gibson 355.
Oh wow, those are really cool guitars with the veritone thing.
Well,
or is that the mono one?
I have two mono versions. I have a 59 and a 69, and I believe everything on that record is the large part of that record is the 69 355.
Very cool.
But mainly because one of the guys that Cliff co-produced some of the songs, and then Russ Paul co-produced some of it. And Russ, when I played on his stuff, he said, no, we're going to play one guitar as much as possible. I want it to be one sound. And so the 355 just ended up on a lot of it, you know.
Yeah. There's a couple of videos of you online with a, it looks like a 335, or is that the 355?
That's the 69 355.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People just love to talk, so I had here also a telly, so no, obviously that's the 355.
Well, okay, that is the telly.
Okay. It says especially in the opening.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, okay. That guitar, that whole song is the telly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, Rob, if I keep saying telly, there's six songs. I got to be right once, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, a broken clock's right. Even a broken clock's right twice a day. And I try to play with that. Do you tune down a half a step for that one?
Yeah, I forgot that I did that until I was learning it with the band, and they were all texting me going, hey, dude, what key are we doing? Are we really going to have to bring extra guitars to play the song? I said, no, we'll do it in standard.
But yeah,
yeah, we did tune down half a step on that.
Okay. You know what? It's you have like a raking thing there just at one point, but it's so well, you know, I think raking does so much for a song, for, you know, a guitar line, and you have this one rake in there. I think it's at the very beginning or maybe a bar after a solo, and it just sounds great.
Oh.
And you probably don't remember because it was incidental, but it just, you know, I noticed it sounded really good. You also have this like kind of like a one note thing going on there with the guitar underneath.
Okay. Are you talking about the low part, or is it a low note?
Correct. Correct. And it's one note over and over. It's like an rhythmic pattern. I just don't know the rhythmic pattern at the top of my head. Where did that, like, how do you, I'm always curious as to the, like, where do ideas generate? Like, how did you come up with that?
You know, I do know what you're talking about. And when I was cutting that with the band, I was playing the chords with everybody, and it just felt like everything was just too blocky with everybody playing the chords. And I don't remember how I stumbled onto it, but I clicked into my session guy mentality where I just kind of went, okay, what do I need to do to make this song like jump a little bit? And I guess that's just, I just did that on one take, and that was like, oh, there's the idea.
Yeah, but that's where, when at least in my, when I'm listening, where like those fills where you just fill up the cracks with just the right amount.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was perfect. I mean, it just did it.
Thank you, man.
It really was great. And I think I know the answer to this, but I love the distortion on that song. I didn't ask Jeff, but was that from your amp or is that a pedal?
Yeah, well, you know what? It's a little bit of both. You know, I'll give Jeff a little bit of credit.
That's
one of my favorite amps that I have on that song. It's a Tweed Tremolux. I've had this amp forever, and Jeff has worked on it, and it sounds really great. It has a nice breakup to it, but on that whole song, I use this a fuzz pedal, actually.
Really? Which one?
It's the Basic Audio Scarab Deluxe.
Cool.
Which I'm in love with that pedal. I've used that pedal for a long time, and that sound that you hear almost through the entire song is the Tele with that fuzz pedal on, but the volume on the guitar backed off, you know, probably down to like 8 or so. If it were a Strat, it'd be on like 8, you know. Man, it just sounds like a great thick overdrive.
It did, yes. I'm surprised it was a fuzz.
Thanks.
And it was funny.
That pedal is fantastic.
I wrote it down. I'm going to check it out online now, just because I need another pedal.
Yeah, right. I know. I've got a mountain of them sitting in this room. Yeah.
Nothing But You. Is that a 335 or was that your 350?
Yeah. That's the 355. Yeah.
See, that sounded like an open. You know, that sounded like a semi-hollow body to me.
Yeah.
I had another same question. It had a really cool muddy distortion. Was that again that Scarab?
No, that is. I'm playing through. That's one of the tracks that Russ Paul produced, and so I was playing my guitar straight into. He has this old Princeton reverb that is an interesting amp. There's not another one like it anywhere in the world. His father-in-law is Billy Sanford, who played the riff of Pretty Woman. Roy Orbison. He was a big session guy he was in Roy Orbison's band, and he played on all that iconic Roy Orbison stuff, and he was a big session player in Nashville until like up through the 80s. And
so he played that's him.
Yes. And,
wow.
And some say that he helped write that riff. I don't know, but anyway, I played through this.
Hey, you're a session guy. How many riffs have you helped written that, you know?
Oh, that's one of the most iconic ever.
But as a session guy, you know that's, you know, very well could easily be true, because how many riffs have you written that you know?
Yeah, yeah. The lines are blurred sometimes on songwriting's credit. We'll say that.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, anyway, he has this old Princeton reverb amp that has a 15-inch speaker in it.
Wow.
It's I don't know the total story about that. He had somebody had this amp, and it's a regular mid-60s blackface Princeton reverb, but it's got a 15-inch speaker. And so we just plugged straight into that and turned it up until it sounded like what you hear on that recording. And that's all that is.
Really good muddy distortion on there.
Yeah, thank you, yeah.
Till Then, it was great vocals on there, and I was wondering if the guitar solo was a different guitar than the rest of the song.
Yeah. So most of the guitars on that song, electric-wise, are the 355. But then the solo is I have a 68 custom Les Paul.
Oh, okay.
And it's a black, black custom with the ebony fretboard. And that, yeah, I don't even remember what amp I played through, probably something small, like a Deluxe Reverb or something. And I think that has the Scarab Deluxe. It's the Scarab Deluxe, with something, some Fender amp with a little bit of a tape echo.
Very cool. Man, I'm actually feeling good that I recognize most of these things.
You got a good ear.
Yeah, I do. I have a pretty good ear. The Secret. I love the slide on there. That's one of my favorite songs. What is that song about? Because the lyrics are so cool. And then the other question is, what did you use to get that effect on your voice? You know, like when you're, sounds like you're singing through a box or.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
How does that
work?
That
was all done. That effect is post-production stuff. Okay. The mix engineer, he just EQ'd it that way and filtered it. I don't know what plugin he used, but it's like
post-production.
Basically, like all mid-range, no lows and no highs, mm-hmm. And distorted. We gained it. I had him gain it up so that it kind of sounds the way that you hear it, if you know. And you know what that song is about? I've been writing that song with Cliff, who I mentioned earlier. We started writing that song probably 15 years ago.
Wow. That's a great story.
Now, the reason that I don't know how many people remember this, but do you remember Scott Peterson?
The guy who killed his wife. Yeah.
And they found her. She eventually, I guess he dumped her off in the ocean and she ended up washing up at some point. You remember that?
Yeah. Was that in California or was it up Boston?
Yeah.
Okay.
In Modesto.
I remember that. Yes.
Yeah. So it was on the news all the time, you know, in the late 90s or whatever, I think. Remember how everybody thought like he was playing this big thing, like he had all these people looking for her, and he was acting like the devoted husband, and he was crying on TV all the time and all that. Well, that inspired this song.
Oh.
Because this song is kind of about, every night I looked at that guy on TV, and I was just like, I know that son of a bitch did it. you know what I mean? And people were suspicious. There were a lot of weird things, you know. If you were around at that time and you heard and you were watching it on the news, it was like half the people thought, oh my God, this poor guy lost his wife, and the other half of the people were like, no, that son of a bitch did it.
He's guilty, yeah.
And it turns out he did it, and so this song is kind of about, I've been trying to write this in a song, and we worked on, we'd get together and we'd go as far as we could, and then we'd go, we can just scrap this take on it. And eventually over the years, I kept pushing it. And he was always like, I think he was tired of hearing the idea because we tried so many times to write it and just never nailed it. And then, when he said, he's the one that came up with the hook line of, the secret that the ocean keeps.
Right. That was really a cool line.
Yeah, and that's Cliff, man.
That prompted a lot of curiosity about what is he talking about here. That's what, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just kind of about this, I guess, like this arrogant guy that's kind of rich and lives in this town, and he kills his wife, and everybody knows he did it, but they can't prove it. And the difference in our song that strays from the actual story of Scott Peterson is that he gets away with it. But his guilt and his what he finds on the other side of getting away with it is that you live with this secret the rest of your life, and you just can't. And you everywhere you go, people know that something's not right about you, and they know. And at the end, he ends up having a heart attack because the stress is just too much, and he ends up dying himself. And as he's dying, the ocean is just pounding in the background like, yeah, I got you, you motherfucker, you know.
So you could actually maybe change it to the secret glove and, you know, just modify it for O.J. Simpson.
Yeah. No, except he's out. I don't want him coming after me.
Yeah,
I don't
good,
want
good
problems
point.
With O.J.
Good point. And the last song, Eloise, really pretty fills. Again, beautiful slide. Did you work that solo out beforehand, or was that improv in the studio?
Well, I knew I wanted to incorporate the main melody line, but beyond that, it was all off the cuff, like I didn't.
Wow, really. That's awesome, man. That's beautiful. I was sitting there saying that he's probably going to say it was improv, but I knew you're being sincere about it. It was beautiful. It was every note was like, you know, just perfectly placed. But I would imagine that being a session guy, you have so many. It's like probably such good training for doing stuff like this, because you're required to just like do this immediately, you know?
Yeah.
So if you do have a little time to stretch out and like actually think about it at night, you know, when you're eating dinner or, you know, whatever it is, you're walking the dog, it probably like almost makes it easy. Not easy, but compared to what the normal conditions.
The thing that you learn how to do as a session player is come up with as many ideas very quick, you know, as you can quickly, and be able to execute them. And you know what I found out is I can do that so much easier on other people's music. When it comes to my music, the hardest thing for me to do is a guitar solo, and I think the reason why is because I think about it least, and when it comes to my records for some reason, and then when I'm in the hot seat and have to do it, I'm just kind of like, oh man, I don't really know what to do here. It's very weird that I get like that in a situation where I should know exactly what I want to do, but I have to actually get myself I really have to hit a special head space to play on my own music as far as guitar solos go, to where I can feel freed up to just do whatever I want to do. And if you heard some of the earlier takes of that Eloise solo, you might laugh, because it's just like, what? Wow, this guy sucks.
I doubt that would have been my reaction.
Well,
but
I mean, it's usually me. It usually starts out with me throwing too many ideas at the space involved, and then I kind of put the guitar down and listen through to a couple things, and then I figure out exactly what I want to do. Whereas if I'm playing on someone else's song, a lot of times I feel like they just love my first solo, you know, because I can click into that headspace on someone else's music easier than I can mine. And I don't know why that is. But
no, it makes actually total sense, because first of all, it's a totally different environment where, you know, creatively, you know, when it comes down to it, it's a session guy in that environment. You don't have the luxury of spending an hour or two to think about something.
Right.
The other thing is, you're always, I mean, if you're a type A personality of a strong work ethic, you're going to be much more demanding of yourself than anybody else would be.
Yeah.
That's just reality for anybody that, in anything, business, music, whatever you're doing, you know. And they will love your solo, because nothing against any of the artists you're playing with, they don't know what they don't know.
Yes.
You know, they don't know what's going on. You know, you may play it and say, man, this sucks, because in your head, you've got six other options. They don't know that.
Right.
And
that's absolutely something that works for me.
Yeah. Yeah. and not like against, it's just, you know, they, and it sounds great to them. It does. But
yeah.
See, you're comparing it to, you know, man, I could do these other things, and they don't have that. They're like, wow, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, so they don't have the ability to, you know, what you know you're doing. So I totally get it, man. It makes a lot of sense,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah, that's actually a great way to put it. Yeah, that's it.
Where are you originally from? Where'd you grow up?
Columbus, Ohio. Yeah.
And what was your childhood like?
You know, it was really interesting childhood, in that my dad was a musician professionally, and you know, I never questioned this career path because of that. Because I grew up watching somebody do it. And I grew up in a musician's lifestyle. So I didn't have anybody doing a 9-to-5 job or, you know, working regular hours or any of that. So
this was a natural, I mean, like, did you ever think of doing anything else when you were a kid, or you just?
Well, the only other thing I was good at as a kid that I thought I might, you know, want to do if I, you know, before I found out that, before I felt like I could do music, was baseball.
Okay.
I was really into baseball.
You're like a Reds fan? You're a big Reds fan?
Yeah, I was when I lived up there. Yeah. You know, I don't follow sports as much as I did back then.
Sure.
But yeah, it was the only thing I had natural ability at. I've never done anything in my life that I had to work at. And I don't know why that is. I just never, I never found it.
I would probably say that's, you probably had to work at being this good at guitar. I mean, you didn't like fall off a log and like, hey, here I am. I would imagine that this is like years and years and years of woodshedding and staying up till all hours of the night. And yeah, the fact that you like it is a mutually exclusive issue from the fact that you're good at it.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, it's not like I didn't work at those things. It's just that none of it ever felt like work ever.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah, it is. I'm lucky. I mean, I took that for granted for a lot of years. I didn't realize I assumed when I looked around and saw people doing what they do for a living or for their life that they feel the same way about what they're doing as I do. It wasn't until much later.
That's interesting.
Good. Yeah, I didn't understand
That is just really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I just assumed that, well, you must be working a desk job because that's what you love to do. Because I'm doing what I love to do. I didn't realize that a lot of people go to jobs that they really don't like and they have to have all these hobbies because they would go crazy, you know.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Was your dad a guitar player?
Well, he was a guitar player, but he was more of a songwriter.
Oh, cool.
Which is probably why the songwriter thing got instilled into me over just being a guitar player.
Sure. What did you learn most from your dad as far as musically?
Musically, you know, well, just that it's not that hard. I shouldn't say not hard. It's not that weird to do this for a living.
Mm. Mm.
You know that, I watched my dad, you know, get up pretty much every day. You know, at whatever point that he would get up. He was always writing songs. He was just always doing it. It just, music was, I think we were the same. Music is always going on in my head.
Yeah.
And I think that he was the same way. And I think a lot of musicians are this way. It's just music is going on in your head at all times. And he followed that, you know. So I grew up with an example of somebody that when they had an idea going, they took time to sit down and flush it out, you know.
So you grew up in basically an art, like an artist, you know, in this case, musical art, but an artist mentality.
Yes.
That's very cool. Did you, when did you move to Nashville?
95, August of 95.
Okay. So I was going to ask, do you know Dave Baker?
Baker.
Probably not from Ohio though, because he's.
No. You know, why would I know him? Because that name sounds familiar.
He's Kelly Pickler's guitarist. He's in Nashville.
Okay.
He's a little younger than you, but he's from Ohio. That's the only reason I asked. But you moved here in 95. You wouldn't know him from there.
Yeah. It's possible we've met. I would have to see his face.
Hmm. So let me ask you this. Everybody pays tuition in, you know, whatever we do. And I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to maybe share one or two mistakes that you made along your journey and what were the lessons you've learned from these.
Whew, you know, I thought, you know, it is hard for me to call them mistakes, though. But I think the biggest mistake that I have made at different points is just not taking time at different like when certain gigs would come along or certain decisions that needed to be made. Not considering all of the, there's such a political side to this business, and I'm really bad at times at considering those things in the decisions.
The political implications of your decisions.
Yeah, yeah, like what type of gigs you take, what type of things the people see you doing, that might keep the people you want from hiring you, or taking gigs just for the money that you just don't believe in or have any, you know, any music, sure. Musical. Yeah. I've just made mistakes along the way, you know, without naming names.
Yeah,
you
sure.
know, you know, I found myself in situations that I was like, this was an awful decision to be out here in public playing this kind of thing. Cause this, you know, I don't want anybody out there thinking that this is what you should call me for, you know,
like
at some point when I got into Delbert McClinton's band, I felt really good about that decision. It wasn't as high profile of a gig as the gigs I was doing up to that point. But I realized that if I just stuck around doing just Music Row kind of CMT type of gigs and becoming that guitar player, I was never going to get called to play on a Buddy Guy record or, get a chance to play, you know, on some of the music that I really cut my teeth on stylistically, you know.
That's got to be a really hard thing because unless you have, because I've heard that answer before, and the only way to avoid that, I would imagine, is you've got to have, like, be very, have a guy watching over you, a mentor, like really watching over you. And then you have to be willing enough to listen or surrender your gut about something and give into that. And then you get into the whole situation of, wow, I'm not being true to myself. I really want to do that. It's a tough thing, I think, to do. I don't know if there's any answer around that.
Yeah, it is tough. I think the things that make it tough is, and the business gets tougher all the time, you know, but coming up, You kind of really have to decide when you start getting hired for things, what you believe in, what you want to do, not what the business throws at you.
Right.
Because the business is going to throw a lot of things at you, and opportunities are going to seem like, oh, if I don't do this, I don't know if anybody else will call. There are times where you have to be flexible about that, but most of the time, man, you know, I would tell anybody, don't go play a gig you hate musically, because the more of that you do, the more of that they're going to call you for.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And you won't even know who the hell you are down the road.
Yeah, you have to have enough belief in what you are doing or want to do to hold out a little bit at times, even if it seems like you are not going to work. You know,
yeah, sure.
It always comes around. You know, you just have to hold out sometimes.
Which I would imagine you being more of a rock blues purist was probably something that you had to deal with a lot in Nashville.
Yes, yeah, because when I moved to town, it was still very much a Brent Mason owned town.
Yeah.
And man, he's one of my favorites. I mean, he's one of the best in the world.
Sure.
You know, and I mean, I love that guy's guitar playing. I just, you know, but I don't play like that.
Right, right, right.
So I was doing a bunch of like country music, CMT. I call them CMT gigs because they're, you know, all those country music stars.
Totally
those
get it.
Kind of things. And man, the second Delbert McClinton started looking, you know, I started playing with him, subbing for the guitar player he had at the time. It was like, if I could ever get that gig, I would turn down the biggest CMT gig to do this because Delbert McClinton is where I need to be musically.
Yeah.
And you know, people, you know, I felt like if I can be seen on stage with him every night, it's going to attract the people that hear what I do. And I'm just going to get hired more and more for that, which is where I shine. You know, it took me a lot longer than other guys to get going that moved here the same time as me. But, you know, I'm happier playing what I play.
And I've heard in the last week from 5 A-list guys that you're a wonderful player. So whatever you did, whatever the time frame, I think it was the right time frame.
Because, thank you.
You know, and I'm not that guy to just say shit, but, you know, whatever you're doing was the right journey for you.
Wow. Somebody's mowing my lawn.
No, it always happens here, man. Believe me.
Yeah.
Okay. What's your, I'm looking at, I'm looking at the clock. I'm trying, I got so many questions to ask you. No, nothing to do with your lawn guy. Okay. In fact, send it to my place. What's your go-to guitar right now? And what other two guitars of yours would make up your top three?
Well, you know, I have one of my dad's Strats.
Oh, wow.
I have three of his guitars. When he passed away, I inherited these three. And I have a 65 Strat of his and a 55 Tele of his. And then I have a cool Guild acoustic. And I play the Strat and the Tele a lot.
That's nice.
You know, I'm associated pretty heavily with this Jeff Senn guitar that he built me. That's a Tele.
What's his name?
Probably Jeff Senn, S-E-N-N.
Jeff Senn, okay.
Jeff Senn guitars. Really great builder. And he's one of my best friends too. And we, you know,
where's he out of?
He lives down the street. He's here in Nashville.
Okay, shout out to Jeff Senn. There you go.
Yeah, and you know, he built me the Sunburst Tele. I had him build this thing that's got a P90 in the neck and a regular Tele pickup in the bridge, and I use that guitar a lot. You know, it feels like my old, he carved the neck out to feel like my old 55 Tele, so it feels very much like that, and it's the only new guitar that I play that really feels like a real good old guitar.
Meanwhile, every picture, every video I've seen of you is with the humbuckers. It's either with
That's
your 355 or, like, on your website, you have, like, it looks, you said it's a Godin, or, no, it's that old Les Paul, it looks like a like a gold top that's been really weathered with P90s, maybe.
Yeah. That's my 53 gold top.
Yeah, that's nice, man.
You know what? I play all these guitars.
I know.
I can't pick a favorite.
Well, that's good, man. That's a good problem to have. Any cool or interesting stories behind how you acquired any of these guitars?
Well, yeah, I should probably tell you about. There's actually a book. It's called A Perfectly Good Guitar, written by Chuck Holly. And it's about how I got my dad's 55 Tele, because when my dad passed away, that guitar was not around, and I expected it to be, because as a kid, I played that guitar around the house all the time. Well, it wasn't there. Nobody knew where it was. And when I moved to Nashville, I started asking some of the people that knew my dad when he was working down here about that guitar, and somebody told me that they thought that Paul Worley bought that guitar, who was a session player and also a producer that produced some of my dad's records back in the 80s. And
what was your dad's name?
Bob, but was his name, he was known as Bobby Jean McNelly.
Bobby Jean McNelly.
Yeah. And I ran into Paul. And I asked him about it, and he said, yeah, I bought that guitar, you know. Your dad was moving back to Columbus and needed the money, and I bought it off of him. And I mean, at the time, I had no money. And I said, well, you know, I don't know. You seem like a guy that doesn't sell anything, but if you ever are getting rid of that guitar, please let me know. I'll come up with the money somehow. I know it's a valuable vintage guitar, but... And about 6 months went by, and our mutual friend that we had called me one day and said, hey, what are you doing tonight? And I said, nothing, you know. He said, well, come by the house around dinner time, you know. And so I said, sure, you know. And I went over there about 5 o'clock or so. And I walked in, and there was this case sitting on the floor. And you know, I wasn't thinking anything of it.
Right.
I didn't even, you know, it's just the guitar case sitting there. And he said, hey, open that case. Check this guitar out. And I opened it up, and I swear to God, I flashed back to the first time. Because my dad did the same thing when he bought the guitar.
Wow.
He bought the guitar at Gruen Guitars, and he brought it home. And I just remember coming in from playing outside, and he said, hey, check out, open this case and check this guitar out. And
wow.
And so I went, yeah, and I went over, and it was a replay of that moment of the first time I ever opened that case and saw that guitar. And it was just like, holy shit.
Wow.
You know, he said, yeah, Paul called me and just told me where the guitar was at his house. And he just said, come over and get that guitar. And I just want Robbie to have it. You know, it belongs with him. He's like, I've got so many guitars, I never play it, you know. And
that's so awesome.
Yeah, really, really cool.
That's a great story. That's one of the best stories I've ever heard about getting a guitar.
It is a great, I mean, I you know, and Paul's done so much for me. I mean, he's such a great guy. I mean, he's the first guy. He produced the first number one song I ever played on, and he hired me on that first Lady Antebellum record, and I played on most of their big songs because of him, you know, and that, you know, he's given me so much that I can't possibly repay him, you know, and every time I see him, he just says, I just keep passing it on, you know, just you'll find somebody else that needs something.
Right,
someday.
Right. That's a great story, man. I'm so happy you got that guitar. Yeah. The way you got it, that's awesome, man. That's really nice. Thank you for sharing that. Ever sell a guitar you wish you can get back?
Yes. I've sold many of them, but the one that bugs me the most is a 64 Rickenbacker 12 string.
Oh, wow.
The George Harrison Rickenbacker 12 string.
What prompted you? I guess you needed money at the time. That's why everybody's.
No. I was an idiot. I was like 17 or 18, and at the time, people were playing Steinbergers and Paul Reed Smiths were new, and everybody was kind of playing those and Ibanez guitars and all that stuff. And all I had were these old vintage guitars that nobody seemed to care about. And I wanted something, you know, new.
If you'd only known, somebody would have whispered, just hang on to it. You'll be the envy in 10 years.
I know. Really, honestly. But I sold that
Nobody
guitar.
Will care about that Ibanez.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I sold that guitar and another great guitar. I sold a 62 SG Junior.
Good Lord.
To this guy up in Columbus. Yeah.
Wow.
And he still, as far as I know, he still has them, and he won't sell them back to me, which makes me really mad. No,
yeah,
he's
I hear
a good
it.
Guy. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, he, I sold them to him, and I think I went and bought. That is so embarrassing. I bought a Steinberger.
Mm. Oh my
God! And I took it to my gig, and I played like half a song on it, and knew instantly that I had fucked up.
Those are the ones with no headstock.
Yeah. This one had the regular Strat style guitar body, but no headstock. You know, I had just seen Alan Holdsworth, and he blew my mind, and he was playing a Steinberger, and I was like, okay, that's what I got to get.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was a big Johnny Winter fan, and when he started playing those, it always was just weird.
Yeah,
it was just like, man, you're Johnny Winter. You're supposed to be playing like a something vintage. You're not supposed to be playing that. It was
exactly.
Just, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I instantly knew that I made a mistake, you know, and then it really hurt because I was a Tom Petty fan, but I didn't pay attention to what kind of guitars those guys were playing. And when I realized that they were playing Rickenbackers and stuff, I was like,
there you go.
Why'd I do that?
Are you outgoing or shy by nature?
You know, it probably depends on the room I'm in.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
That's a good answer, actually.
Yeah, you know, most of the time not, but sometimes, you know.
Sometimes you're quiet.
Sometimes if I'm around, you know, people that are really, really...
Bunch of dicks.
Yeah. Well,
no, that's called smart. That's not called quiet, shy. That's called, you know, not wasting your energy. At least that's what I call it.
I can tell when I don't have very much in common with people.
Yeah.
And if I feel like, we don't really have much to talk about, then you know, I stay on the quiet side.
Yeah, I'm actually the same. I'm very outgoing, but like if I'm very outgoing, but I will never waste my, you know, to me, time is the most valuable commodity. And so like, you know, I would never waste it. You know, I wouldn't be rude, but I can't do the fish on the wall thing. You know, it's just not my thing.
I'm the same way. Yeah.
Most important thing your father taught you.
I guess it's probably just being a musician, you know.
How about mom? Most important thing your mom taught you?
You know, my mom really taught me to, she was the counterbalance to that, the other side of the coin where, you know, she would, keep me mindful of checks and balances, you know, just things like, you know, yeah, it's cool to go do this, but you also got to be able to pay your bills and know that you've got enough money in your account to pay your bills and always be thinking ahead.
Yeah. You know? So it was like the artist mentality versus the keeping shit together mentality, you know? That makes a lot of sense. What's your superpower, man? You have a superpower.
Whew. man, you know, that's a tough one to answer. What's yours? Maybe that would help me.
You really want to know?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a sign of a shitty story, but it's not really. So I have a really bad childhood and like really bad. But, and they've done studies on this, when like abused kids grow up, as a kid, you have to be able to identify the environment you're walking into in a split second. So like you're turning the key and you have to fucking know, okay, is this like mellow? Is this like Beirut? Is it a war zone? Is it like what's, you know, and you have to know immediately because you got to be prepared. So what that does is I'm pretty good at identifying, like, this sounds very weird. I'm from New York City, but this sounds like very California, like people's energy. So like I'm good at reading like, you know, someone's sincerity and, you know, not, I wouldn't say 100%, but pretty, I get good. My vibes about people are very accurate, you know?
Yeah.
And it's gotten better as I've gotten older, because when I was younger, I was, you know, having that background, I kind of had a little bit of a negative attitude. I was very skeptical of people, which should naturally be having that background. I'm not now at all. I'm very open-minded and, you know, but I'm good at reading people, you know, I guess intent. I'm good at reading people's intent. So.
Yeah. Man, if that makes any sense.
Really?
Yes. Yes, because I mean, I had a really rough upbringing. I mean, my dad was as great as it was being around a musician. He was also a musician in the 70s and the 80s and doing a lot of the things that people were doing back then.
Right, right.
Drug wise and alcohol and all that, you know, and the partying and really not a great role model in any other way except music.
Yeah. So you had to raise yourself and you had to figure out. You probably the same as me then. Like, my dad didn't teach me anything to do. He taught me everything what not to do.
Yes, yes. There was a lot of that for me.
Which is a valuable lesson. But
it is. It is. It's tough because you learn all the hard stuff up front.
Yeah.
You know, but yes, as I was listening to you talk about your superpower, that is exactly how I am.
Yeah.
I mean, I was always scared to death of what kind of mood my dad was going to bring into the house.
Oh, fuck yeah. But, what the hell is, what war zone is it today?
Yeah, I've grown up that same way and have tried really hard to work through that as well to be where you're at, and which is where, you know, you start out from a skeptical place.
Yeah, very.
But you learn through time that you know, you can be it is safe also, and you learn how to start looking for the positive side of the things you might be hyper vigilant about.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Whatever.
Well, for me, what helped was, first of all, I went to some counseling a long time, but I learned, I just had to look at myself better before I was able to look at somebody else better. And it's just not possible to happen any other way. Now,
yeah.
I mean, I appreciate what you said. You want to, far be it to think I have my shit together, because I don't. I'm just a work in progress like everybody else. But
it just took
a long time. And when I started, I just said, I'm fucking sick of this. It's just like, I don't want to have this outlook. I want the world to be a nicer, better place. Well, I had to look at myself as a nicer, better person. And that took a long time, to be very honest with you. Like a lot of times people will say to me now, man, you're such a nice guy. And I have a hard time with that. Not because I don't think it's true, but because it's a foreign thing. Because I spent so many years like angry. And so my response is always, you know, hey, thanks very much. But, you know, you're seeing the band after they've been playing together three times a day for 10 years, you know.
Yeah.
You didn't see the band, you know, when they couldn't fucking put a note together, you know. And I guess, and nor should they, because they're just meeting me today for what I am. But it's in my head. So that's like my next journey to sort of like, you know, just accept something like that. Like when someone's that kind to me, it's like overwhelming. And I know they're being kind because they probably think I'm nice, you know, but it's like all those emotions are sometimes overwhelming. All those nice emotions are overwhelming to me to process in a good way. I mean, I don't reject them, but it just has to take a little while to sit in, you know, I have to take a breath and, you know, appreciate it and feel good about it and let myself do that, you know?
So. Yeah, yeah. No, that is a very hard thing to learn how to do with this kind of background.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, that's a huge step to be able to do, I think.
It was for me. And I tell you what, the thing that helped me the most was my wife was she's just a great person. And I wanted to be better for her. And then and then I realized, okay, in order to be better for her, I got to be better for me first.
Yeah.
You know? But like, it was interesting when you were talking about how you grew up and like, oh, I thought everybody did what they liked to do. See, I grew up the other way. My dad was miserable. So I thought, oh, you grow up and you're miserable.
Yeah.
That's normal. You grow up and you fucking hate the world and you do a job you hate. So I had to unwind all of that shit and do it the other way. And I've been self-employed now for 20 years. So thank God everything's been okay. But it took a long time again to get, you know, I always think I'm a late bloomer. It's just, that was my journey. You know, it took a long time to get there. So,
yeah. Well, glad you're here.
Yeah, man. Thank you. Me too. I'm glad you're here. Any hobbies or interests outside of music?
You know, my daughter, you know, really.
That's a great one.
I mean, you know, I love doing things that she likes to do.
What does she like to do?
Nothing musical.
Well, that's good, actually. You know, that's actually
good.
Yeah,
it is good. She's really into horses. She shows horses.
That's great.
Man,
you better be playing on some number one records.
Oh, good God. Tell me about it. That's the truth.
How old is she?
She's 10.
That's great.
Just turned 10, that's her passion. And you know, she's also a very artistic child. As far as like, she loves to do creative things, like you know, drawing or or, you know, tonight, if she's still awake when I get home from my session, we're going to make a video together. I just got her this film app on her phone, and we've sketched out this murder mystery video that we want to make.
That's awesome, man. And you're going to write a song. You're going to write a song about it, the secret something, right?
Yeah. I actually she wants me to make really scary sounds with my guitar and record them and put them on her phone, and then we'll put images to it. So yeah, I'm really excited about those kind of things with her, you know.
Yeah, those are good projects to do because they get a bigger quick, man.
Yeah.
Favorite place you've traveled?
There's a lot of them, but you know, the place that I enjoy being in the most is probably New York City.
Really? What do you like about it? And where do you like going? If you even know the places.
Well, it's different every time. I have a few places that I go to, you know, almost every time I'm there, but I don't set out to make that happen. You know, it's just the energy of that.
It's amazing,
city.
Isn't it?
It is, yeah. and I felt that way every time that I've gone there. It's just like everything's buzzing, everybody's moving around and getting stuff done, and so many things are happening all the time, and I love being close to that. It's like it's just this energy that gets inside you and or at least me, and some people it probably makes nervous, but for me, I thrive on that environment.
Yeah, it's a very. I grew up there, like I said, and I'm very grateful for that. And I got exposed to so many kind of people living there, which was really cool. You know, all race, creeds, color, ethnicities. You know, it's funny because I know accents real well. So like we'll be sitting down and the waiter will come, and if I'm with another couple or something, it's like, oh, that guy's Lebanese. I'm like, what do you mean that guy's Lebanese? How do you know? I was like, just ask him. You know,
yeah.
My buddy, where are you from? Lebanon.
That's great.
It's not like the, you know, my first rodeo hearing a Lebanese accent, sort of, you know, so it was a good place to grow up. Two more questions, Rob. Best advice you've ever been given, and who gave it to you?
You know, interestingly enough, I just reconnected with this guy's wife. There was this guitar player up in my hometown that I didn't really know all that well, but I knew who he was because he played around a lot, named Ray Fuller. And I remember one time I was playing, we played some benefit for, I don't remember what it was now, but the thing, you know, it was a Stevie Ray tribute kind of night. And I was really into Stevie Ray and all that. But we were watching other people that were not in the, you know, that didn't know anything about Stevie Ray, and were jumping on the bandwagon, getting up and playing a song and just butchering everything. And I was standing next to him backstage, and, you know, I was young. I was probably 19, 18, something like that. And he just leaned down to me and said, you know, you always got to do what you got to find what you're good at and really just follow that and nothing else, because people can tell when it's not sincere and it's not genuine. And you know, that may have been the only thing that guy ever said to me, I think. You know, I mean, we did not know each other, but I remember it like it just happened yesterday, and I've thought about that so many times. I probably owe him a thank you, because there's been so many times where I started to do something because I thought it would get me a gig, or, you know, just even simple as the way I would interact with people socially or whatever, or pretend to like things that I did that I really did not like at all, you know.
Sure.
And him telling me that, it was just kind of like this very obvious thing, but just somebody saying it out loud into your face, you know, it was just like it had a profound effect on me, and I remembered that, you know, all these years.
Do you think that's kind of what helped you in those times where you looked at, you know, you said, I can't keep doing these CMT gigs?
Yeah.
And then I want to get something like Delbert McClinton's gig.
Yeah.
That's great, man. That's good.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely where that came from, you know, what reinforced that.
Yeah. Last question. Tough question.
All right.
As if the others were easy. What's your definition of happiness?
Man, you know, I think we're always on the path of that and trying to figure that out every day. But I think it's about being comfortable in your skin. You know, that sounds cliche. That sounds
not at all.
But you know, it's so valuable, and it really is the most important thing. I mean, you've got to find out who you are and be true to that, and always stay on the pursuit of that.
Yeah,
I would agree. It doesn't always reward you in every single way, but you start learning that it rewards you in the most important ways, probably.
Mm. Man, I really appreciate your time. I'd like to. Thank you, but I want to promote, where could people buy RMC Volume 1?
Well, it's up on iTunes. You can get it there. And like you said, you can stream it on Spotify as well. Those are the two places where you can get it. Or if you happen to be in Nashville and see that I'm playing, you can get an actual physical copy. You know.
Is that you put your tours on, or where you're playing, on your website or anything like that?
I do, and there's nothing up there right now because I was supposed to be out with Seeger, but since he's cut the tour short unexpectedly due to some health concerns, you know, I kind of landed back in Nashville, so I'm getting ready to book a bunch of shows and should have some stuff up there in the next couple months. So
great. Everybody, it's Rob McNelly, McNelley. The name of the EP is RMC Volume 1. It's really... If you are into rock, blues, classic rock, it's just a great album. Good vocals, everything. And again, I have no incentive other than to tell the truth that it's a wonderful album. Man, I'd like to have you back on the show when you have your next album come out. And there's a lot of questions. A lot of therapy we still have to go through here, Rob.
Yes, I can see that. I like this.
Hey, man, I cannot thank you enough for your time, honestly. I know you're so busy, man. It's great talking to you. Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening. Thanks again to Rob McNelly for spending his time with us. We all appreciate it. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with other cool new things for guitar players. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have some fun. Till next time, I'm out, everybody. Thanks for listening. Peace. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.